Cool. I'm Jack. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
So great to meet some of you. We've had a couple of you visit us down in down at our Dunwoody meeting. My last drink was July 13th, 1997. That was my last drink. I was telling my story, I guess it was about 10 years ago. I was at the 8111 Club. A lot of you know 8111. It's where I sobered up. I'll be talking about that a little bit. But it was at the 545 meeting. They call it the happy hour, appropriately named. It's a great meeting. People run in there after work, and I love that meeting. It's a meeting where when I first started coming to AA, and I went to several meetings. That wasn't my regular meeting, but I liked that meeting because people would come in from work. They'd walk into the meeting, and they would just exhale. You know that exhale? You got all the world, weight of the world on you, and you get into your meeting, and you sit down, particularly if it's your home group, and you just exhale. And I love to hear that sound. But anyway, they asked me to tell my story up there, and they had not been doing that for a long time, and normally they have open discussion. So I'm telling my story, and I'm sitting up there, and I'm about halfway into it, and a guy had come in a little bit late, and he was sitting in the back, and he said, "Are you ever going to shut the F up?" And I started laughing. I thought that was... obviously he didn't know it was a speaker meeting. So we had a good laugh about it, and he came up afterwards. And I love stuff like that. I love AA. Particularly around a clubhouse, you can really get some entertaining things happen. But, if somebody comes in late and is not aware, you might want to tell him this is a speaker meeting. He's not doing it. Long-winded discussion. I love AA because we I've sponsored a few people, and we always say, I tend to say, you know, we've got plenty of time to get into the steps, and we'll get into your fourth and fifth step. We'll take our time. We'll get into it when we need to. But, you know, don't go over 3 minutes when you're sharing, particularly when I want to share. So sometimes people get a little long-winded. I'm put my phone up here so I can kind of watch the time. First time I told my story, I wasn't watching the time, and I went 15 minutes over, and I didn't realize it. And they were so nice listening to me. And I had just gotten to sobering up. You know, it was a long drunk club. I hadn't been sober for a year, but... my last drink was, July 1997, and the next day I was on my way to a treatment center. But I grew up, in North Atlanta, and kind of had a Leave It to Beaver kind of upbringing. I mean, it was the baby boom, and you know, it was a nice neighborhood. We lived on a cul-de-sac. We had nice parents, and you know, the kids, you just could go into anybody's house. Every kid was welcome everywhere. Every kid could demand a snack wherever they were, snacks on demand. And we just ran through the streets, and we just had a lot of kids, a lot of fun. I think it was a neat time to grow up. It was, it seems fairly happy. My parents, my dad might have been an alcoholic. I don't know. I mean, the evidence is not really... He certainly had a lot of tendencies in his personality. He tended to have a violent temper, and he and my mom didn't get along real well. But he also had a control over it. You know, it seems like he could stop when he wanted to. My mom liked to have her few glasses of wine, but, you know, no crazy, you know, alcoholic like I hear. So many people are traumatized by that. But they... you know, they fought a lot, and I think that created some uncertainty, some disruption in a child. You know, it's hard. They separated, and they finally got divorced. But anyway, I was always, as a kid, I was a worrier as a kid. I don't know. I think I was 12 or 13 before I ever exhaled. I don't know. I carried pressure, and in the time I grew up, it was the job of the older kids to scare the hell out of the younger kids about everything. I mean, it was like, you know, oh, you got Miss Johnson as your third grade teacher. Oh no, yo, you're in for it now. You know, we had to do these duck and cover drills, so we were going to get nuclear bombed. Had the Cuban Missile Crisis, so there's a lot to worry about. And every grade got harder, and it's like, man, I can barely handle second grade. How am I going to do third grade? Now I'm going to, you know, I was projected as a little kid. I was restless, irritable, and discontent as a child. Clearly, I was very impatient. My dad, you know, he had a vocabulary of a sailor, and he had a very short fuse, and I either got it genetically or adopted it. But you know, I mean it was generally a happy childhood. It was pretty safe and secure, but I was a worrier. And I guess it was around 13 or 14 when I discovered some other things. We're starting to experiment with marijuana, and really didn't have as much access to alcohol, but I loved that, because it changed the way I felt. Somehow it made me a part of a whole group. I remember in eighth grade, I felt very isolated. I didn't know where I fit in. And when you start doing those things, all of a sudden you've got a whole new group of the cool kids. You know, you go hang out with cool kids. So did that, got pretty into it. Again, we didn't have as much alcohol, but I sure loved it. I mean, the combination of alcohol and a little marijuana, those of you that have done it, it is wonderful. So, and it worked for me. I remember it was my friend's birthday. We were probably 13 or 14. This kid and I were running around, and we were smoking a little, you know, dope and running around, chasing girls and all that kind of stuff. And so we decided, it was a Saturday morning, we got into my dad's scotch, and we drank that, and it was perfect for me. It was not perfect for him. He got sick. I didn't get sick. I mean, I went to heaven. I mean, I had a spiritual experience. I just had a little bit, and I mean, all the promises came true. Really did. And so it was profound for me. And again, I didn't get sick, didn't go crazy. And it seems like early on I did have a modicum of control. So I wonder sometimes whether I maybe drank myself into being an alcoholic. I think you can do that. Or was it genetic? You know, I think somehow. But I know however I got there, I got there. I know I'm an alcoholic. But anyway, fast forward a few years. So we had those years. And then when I was when I was 15, I had a spiritual experience through some people I knew. And I completely, you know, again, without help, it is too much for us. And I had help. It didn't occur to me, though, that I was an alcoholic or an addict. I mean, I was just a teenager having fun. But I was also searching. I was deeply searching for meaning in life. And to the point of annoying my friends. I mean, I'd ask my Jewish friends, do you know who God is? I mean, the Jewish people got it right? I grew up around a lot of Jewish people. The Christian people got it right? So I was hungry. It was a spiritual hunger. And I think alcohol fills that hole, quite frankly. I think the alcohol fills that hole, and did a good job for me. But anyway, I had a spiritual experience, and I didn't have the need to drink or to do anything else. And I had a pretty good 4 or 5 years, got through college, and then it was, ironically, it was in a church I was in, and they were kind of like a cult. I don't get too tied up in it, but they're a very, very strict church. And but we drank. The church drank, and the pastors drank. So we started drinking a little bit, and I had a real taste for it. I mean, I really liked it. On Friday nights, we would go and have 4 or 5 beers, and we'd smoke cigarettes, and, you know, which is not that unusual for a junior or senior in college, but when you hadn't been doing anything, it's different, it's new, and I loved it. I mean, I just started looking forward to Friday nights. I mean, just, you know, go out and do that. So I got through that. I got As a result of not drinking and the spiritual experience, I had a pretty good career started. And I guess, you know, in my career, I worked for a big corporation. I was in sales. And that's when it really started kicking in. I mean, I started drinking. I really didn't like my job that much. And I love to drink. I mean, I just love to drink. I love the way alcohol made me feel. And I didn't realize I was addicted to it. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I ran around with friends, and we all would laughingly, jokingly say, well, we're alcoholics. We're supposed to drink. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. And on the weekends, we'd start on Saturday morning, and we wouldn't stop till Sunday night. But anyway, so the signs of my drinking started to show up at work, and I wasn't drinking in the morning yet, but we partied so late. We partied like 6 in the morning, 6, 7 in the morning, you know, when the sun's coming up and you just got to go get in the shower and try to put a suit on, manage your way into the office. And I didn't realize, I don't think the alcoholic often realizes how much they smell. But and I thought I was pulling off. I thought I was sneaking around. And I had a friend come to me, and he said, Chief, what's going on? He said, everybody in the office is talking about, you know, you're smelling like alcohol at work. I mean, is there a problem? And I said, well, I, you know. So he was talking to one of the managers, and I said, well, what'd you tell him? And I said, well, I told him I thought you were depressed. You know, you'd gone through some loss in your life. I lost my parents early. And I wanted to deny that. I said, no, I'm not depressed. I never have particularly had a problem with depression. But then I said, wait a minute. That sounds pretty good, actually. As long as we can steer it away from the drinking? Yeah, so anyway, so always been a pretty good con man, and I'd get confronted, and I could usually con my way out of it, talk my way out of it. But I finally got a manager that wasn't going to be BS'd away, and he confronted me one time, and he said, if this happens again, he said, we're going to do something about it. We're going to address this. So I did not want it to happen again. I really didn't. I really tried. I did not want that meeting to come. And it was one, you know, and it's hard, you know, once you start drinking. So again, it was one of those late nights, and I'm sneaking in the back way up in the building and going up the freight elevator, and this little gal followed me. She was one of our, we called them customer engineers, and I didn't know she was following me, but she did. She came back to my office, and it's One Atlantic Center. It's a big building in Midtown, and she found out where my office was. She called the security for my company, and I got that thing from my manager. He said, can you come into my office for a minute? It's that tone that, you know, it's not good. You know, it's not like, we're going to give you a raise, we're going to give you a bonus. No, I dreaded it, and I went in, and he said, you know, we talked about it. And he said, over the cologne, over the cigarettes, he said, I still smell the alcohol. He said, you got to do something about it. So I, again, the ever con man, when that meeting broke up, I went real quick, I called EAP, Employee Assistant, so I'd make it look like my idea. And so I went back in, and I said, okay, yeah, I've contacted Employee Assistant. We're going to get into it. He said, no. You didn't contact Employee Assistant. I confronted you on this. And so it's a little more of a forced march. So I, delaying as much as I possibly could, was put into the first treatment center, and it was to save that job that I really didn't like all that much, but I knew I was kind of a bad drunk, and I couldn't get a job that good, and I needed the money to drink. So I figured I'd go in there, and I mean, I really don't have the words for what drinking meant to me. It was everything. It was, you know, it made me feel okay with the world. And so I had no intention of quitting drinking, but I was going to try to really control it. I was going to get some good ideas in there and try to control it. So I went to my first treatment center. That was Peachtree Parkwood. no longer there. It's down at Lanoff 85, and it was a great treatment center. I mean, I met a guy who's still a friend who was my counselor, and I got in there, and I was hip, slick, cool. I was, this wasn't for me. This was for all these other poor people that were in here. Good for them. I'd had some exposure to AA younger, as a younger man. A good friend of my father's was in AA, and he was just a wonderful man, Lewis Nelson. He's passed away now, but Lewis really loved me and really loved my dad. He knew my dad and I were having problems, so he actually took me to an Alateen meeting. And he told my dad that, he was taking me to get help, and he told me, I'm taking you to get help from your dad. And I went to that AA meeting. I know where it was. It's where the Safe and Sound meeting meets now in Sandy Springs. I actually realized 40 years later when I was leading a meeting up there that was the same place. But I had gotten a wonderful impression of Alcoholics Anonymous as a teenager because I knew there were caring people. And I remember after the meeting, I remember watching the alcoholics, and this is going back 45 years probably. But I remember those AAs in there, and I remember how happy they were, and I remember how they made me feel. I said, these are joyful people. And I'd been to churches, where after church, it wasn't the same feeling. I mean, I'm not down on churches at all, but these people really loved being there. They were like people whose lives were being saved. I mean, an amazing thing was happening, and there was just such happiness and joy there. So I had a good impression of AA. I didn't avoid it. It just wasn't for me. I mean, it was for the people that needed it, not for me. So I was very resistant in my first treatment center. I was a rule breaker. I mean, I smoked in the bathroom, and I was hard to control because I didn't want to be controlled. But anyway, went through that, and it turned out I got to do some extended treatment. I got to go to an extended day program, which I liked very much because it beat work. I mean, I just hated work. And in this day treatment program, we got to do art therapy, and we got to do all kinds of things, and I enjoyed it, and it just beat the hell out of work. And then they fed us good, so I was feeling better. So then I did get to AA. I started going to a meeting called the Bill Wilson Luncheon. It was down in Sandy Springs. Used to meet at the Steak and Ale restaurant, met every day during the week, and met some friends there, got a sponsor. Went about a year and a half, and I had pretty intensive. I was inpatient, then I was outpatient, lived in a halfway house for 3 or 4 weeks. Then I stayed in the night program, and then I went to AA, and I did some individual therapy. So I had a lot of help, and accrued about a year and a half of sobriety. And but I don't think, in my own opinion, I still wanted to drink. It was not as good as drinking. It was not as good. It was good. It was really good. I admit it was good. I liked waking up without a hangover. But it wasn't doing for me what I remembered the alcohol had been doing for me. So I decided to try an experiment. I left the job that I got sober to save. I sobered up, and with a clear head, I was like, I hate this. Why am I here? And I left that. That's one of the good things. You start to figure out some truth about yourself, when you sober up. So I actually started a business with a buddy, and we were going along, and it was fine, and we're having a little celebration, and I was out with a friend, and I decided to have a glass of wine. I wanted to test it. I wanted to see, had this all been an overreaction? Maybe I could drink and control it. So I had the glass of wine, and the experiment went very well. I did not, that's all I had. I had a glass of wine, You know, the apeshit crazy switch didn't flip. I didn't wind up in Daytona Beach naked, you know, in the middle of, you know. I actually went home and went to bed, and I said, well, this is great. This is great. This was all an overreaction. Again, nothing against AA. AA was great for those who needed it. Wonderful place. I mean, I would recommend it to people that needed it. But anyway... the second experiment, I upped the ante a little bit to a half carafe of wine. I did flip the switch. And they talk about the blood alcohol barrier in our brain when we cross it, and that's when the alcoholic flips the switch, and that's when it's just on, man. It's just on. We can't not drink, you know, once we get over that thing. And that's where I got to, and it was, about a week later, within a period of 10 days, I picked up a half gallon of scotch. Nothing progressive about this at all.
No.
And I tell people that was not all for me, for God's sakes. I mean, I got it to go share with my alcoholic buddies. And it was so wonderful when I got back in that scotch. And I swore, I said, well, even if it turns out I'm an alcoholic, I'd rather do this. I'd rather feel like this. I don't care if I die. This is too good to give up. And that passed quickly. So I was 33 or 34 when that happened. So I claim about 8 or 9 days of successful drinking after a year and a half, you know, after being sober a year and a half. And then it got bad and it got worse. And tearfully bad. I mean, it was just, I could not stop drinking. I could not stop drinking. So I guess the good news is I found out, oh, you are an alcoholic. You know, you really are an alcoholic. I kept going to meetings. I kept going back to my Bill Wilson luncheon, and I'd go back ashamed because these people had been so nice to me and helping me sober up. They were nice people, and I was picking up white chips, and I just couldn't stop drinking, and I stopped picking up white chips. I couldn't stop drinking, and I'd share would be, you know, this is, here I am, I'm at the meeting, but I'm going to leave here and I'm going to the liquor store because I could not stop drinking. So it got worse and worse. It got round the clock. I'd started what I call a home alone business, and that's dangerous for an active alcoholic. I mean, at least when I had to go into the office, there was something to interrupt that. But I mean, I was having the scotch in the morning, scotch and water in the morning, to stop shaking. Actually, to try to go in and get on the PC and type with it because I was shaking too much, just to calm down enough for that. So. You know, the four horsemen that the book talks about, they all visited me. So anyway, and it was just hard. I mean, the alcohol just wasn't working for me anymore. And that's the cruel thing about alcoholism, in my mind, is it's something that's the answer and works so well for so long, it turns on us. It turns on us, and then it doesn't work. And then where are we left, you know? Where are we left? We can't imagine life with it or without it. So I had a partner, and I was sober when we started. And this poor guy that I started with, a nice guy too, but he was a musician. He wanted to get off the road. So we had a pretty good thing going, but his mom was an alcoholic. You know, his father had died early. He had abandonment issues. So when I started drinking, it was, you know, kind of ugly there. But and I ignored. I just couldn't. I couldn't work. You know, I couldn't pay bills, and I couldn't open orders and take checks out. I mean, when I finally came back and dealt with it, I had piles of correspondence, and it was checks and bills. You know, I was not just taking the checks out. You know, no, I'm not doing any of it. But anyway, I was at my home alone office, and I looked out the window. I live in a townhouse, and I can kind of see who's coming up, and I saw somebody drive up, and it was somebody familiar. And I said, well, that's interesting. They're stopping by. And I saw another car come up with somebody else I knew that wasn't really related to that. I said, that's interesting. And then Then the third one came. I said, oh, I see what's going on. They're doing an intervention. And even though I'd been praying for God to help me, God, please, please relieve this alcoholism. I mean, please relieve this. Somehow get me out of this. I didn't know how to do that. Well, here comes God showing up in the form of people. So my response was to, I ran out the back door. And I did not want to be in an intervention. But anyway, a couple of friends of mine, one was my counselor who I'd met in that treatment center, and he said something that I love that I want to go back to real quick, but his name's Tom, still a friend. But he said to me when I was in the first treatment center, he was introducing himself, and he's a recovering alcoholic. And we were talking a little bit, and he said, Jack, he said, you have no idea how sick you are, you know. And I didn't feel that sick, but in retrospect, I mean, those are some of the truest words that were ever spoken to me. Because you don't know until you start to come out of it. But anyway, Tom was there, another buddy that had been a friend of mine through my early spiritual experience, and he was involved in the intervention. So they said, well, he's run out the door, but we know Jack, he's going to have to stop and have a cigarette, so let's just wander out and see if we don't catch up with him. Sure enough, Jack's have a cigarette, and here they come. And I'm like, keep your distance. You could still run pretty fast at that time. So. They said, well, we're not going to force you to do anything. Just come back and listen. So I did. I went back and listened, and and went around the room, and I had both my parents were deceased, but they had both remarried, and I had step parents who loved me very much, and I still do. I've still got one that's still left. I was with her yesterday, my stepmom, and she kind of organized this deal. But they went around the room, and my stepfather is just such a wonderful man, and I loved him so much. And he's in tears. He's like, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know if he knew I was an alcoholic. So I listened to everybody, and they had me scheduled to go over to Bradford, which is over north of Birmingham, Warrior, Alabama. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Bradford. It's a neat treatment place, and we were paying for it this time, so it was also a low-cost deal. I took everything under advisement. I said, look, I'm not going to go right now. And I didn't. I said, but I will give it serious consideration. And I'll let you know. You know, here's the same guy. I'm praying, oh, God, please help me. Please save me. I'm miserable. And, well, let me think about it. You know, let me think about it. So, anyway, and then I talked to another guy who was in recovery, who was kind of like the coordinator. So we finally, I negotiated a few things. I said, well, I'm going to have to have, they come and pick you up, which is kind of cool, because they find that the alcoholics who say they'll show up and meet, they have a higher percentage if they actually pick you up and put you in the car and take you over. Have a higher percentage of people who show up. So I said, okay, that's fine. But I said, I'm going to have two or three beers on the way over. I mean, I-20 to Birmingham, that's a long drive. So that was okay. We negotiated that, and I did that. But I needed to. See, the first time I tried to detox myself before the treatment center, which is a mistake. I mean, all the old hands say, oh, you're an idiot. No, you come in here loaded, and then they let them take care of that stuff. But so this time, I wasn't loaded, but I did have a couple of beers. I got in there. Again, it was July 13th. It was Friday the 13th, and that was my last drink. And July 14th was the day my life began in 1997. But they took me over there, and I was desperate. And I had had, you know, some spiritual connection before, but I couldn't get the spiritual connection back when I was drinking. I mean, that peculiar, that neutrality, you know, the built on, I think that's so perfectly stated, that peculiar neutrality where I don't have to drink. I couldn't get that. I lost the connection. I could not get reconnected, and I had it the first time. They used to say when I got sober, they said the first time's a gift. first time you sober up. And I never believed that. I'd only been sober once. I said, how do you know? Well, it was true for me because the second time was almost impossible. But anyway, I got over there and, you know, they give you the vitamin B and whatever. But and I remember I went to pray and I don't know, I had some hope. And I prayed, you know, for God's will to be done. I prayed for his help to get sober. And all of a sudden, I felt the peace come over me again. I felt reconnected again. I had hope, and I knew it was going to be okay. I knew it was going to be okay. I knew it was over. I mean, I was like tearful. It was like dying. It was like all my drinking life, all the things I loved, I was watching all that die. And I was starting anew. So it was sad, the grief related to sobering up, but it was also hopeful and optimistic. And in this treatment center, where I was resistant in the first treatment center, I said, I'm going to be willing. Everything they asked me to do, I'm going to do. And they had weird rules, like, stand, you know, if you want to smoke a cigarette, you had to go stand behind this line. I said, well, I'm going to go stand behind that line. And there's something about just giving in. No matter what it is, just giving in. There's something so powerful about that. So I actually was over there just for detox, came back to Atlanta and got involved. They had outpatient center here. And then I went to them and I said, you know, I need to go back. I need to go back to Warrior. I need to go back to that place. And so I went back. They came back and picked me up a second time. And I went back for the... and I stayed for about a week to 10 days, and it just, God, was so great. I loved it over there. And I had so messed up everything in Atlanta with my home alone business and all my unpaid invoices and uncashed orders and unprocessed, you know, just a mess. And that worried me, you know, that did worry me. I said, well, I actually just wanted to stay over there. I mean, is there some way we can just sell all that shit back in Atlanta? I'll just move here. Because it was up in the woods, beautiful place. Had little cabins and everything, and I just liked it. So one night they had a, let's see how we're doing on time. Oh, good. They had this thing called Bridge, and it was a deal where they brought in recovering people with different amounts of time. So they sat up in front of us, and there's probably 50 to 100 patients, and then there were four or five up in front of us, and they had somebody with 2 or 3 years, somebody with 5 years, somebody with 10 years. It had been through this program. It was still sober, and all the way up to 20, 25 years. And they said, we're going to have that tonight, and it'll be open. You know, you can ask questions. And so my question was, how do I go back and fix everything I messed up? I mean, it's... like most good alcoholics, I couldn't get focused on, you know, just staying sober would be a really, really great idea. No, I got things I got to fix. I got things I got to do. I got to get all straightened out. We were talking about the roundup in Atlanta. Did anybody get to the Atlanta roundup this time? Maybe not. But Clancy was supposed to be there, but his replacement, I think a man he sponsors, spoke. And he had a great story, but he was in the military, and when he got out of the military, he had sobered up, and he was going back to California or to L.A. or San Diego, wherever his home was, and he went into a meeting, and all the way up the coast, California, he's thinking, I've got to get a career, I've got to get my life together, I've got to make money, I've got to, you know, wasn't even thinking about sobering up. So he goes into a meeting, and... he meets an old-timer, comes over, starts talking to him, says, hey, how you doing? He says, well, I'm good. He said, I just got sober. I just got out of the military. And he said, don't, you know, we don't really need to get to know each other. You're not going to see much of me around here because I've got to get busy with my life. I've got to get on with my life. And the old-timer kind of laughed and said, son, he said, I know you think that AA is a place you visit, is a place that you're going to visit and you live out in the world. If you're going to stay sober, you're going to have to learn that AA is where you live and you visit the world. I love that perspective. I love that perspective. So that man became his sponsor. But anyway, I was sort of like that. And so I went, I was asking this esteemed panel in front of us. And there was another thing. I was sitting out there in the crowd and I said, I want to be one of those guys, you know. I want to be the after story, not the before story. I want to be the after. Because they looked so happy. I mean, they were groomed, they showered, they had nice clothes, they had smiles on their faces. And I said, you know, I want to be one of those. You know, I want to sit up there one day. But anyway, so I asked a question and I said, you know, how do I fix everything I messed up? And so the first guy asked, he said, what you probably need to do is... you probably need to think about not drinking and going to meetings. And then I went to the next guy, and he said, what I think you ought to do is go and find you a home group, and you're probably going to need a meeting a day. And, you know, you probably want to get a sponsor. And I'm like, is anybody listening? That was not my question at all. But it turns out that was the answer. And finally, the last guy, I thought I got to the 25-year man. I thought for sure he was going to give me a straight answer and give me some help. And he said, well, my answer is going to be a little different. He said, I think you need to do what those guys before me said. So I did. I came back. I had been to 8111 Club, and it was the only AA I knew. I lived close to it, and they have a lot of meetings over there. And I had felt spirituality in AA meetings, you know, the first time around. I mean, I was sober for a year and a half. I liked it, you know. So I went back to 8111, and I decided, I sort of went and interviewed all the meetings. I said, I'm going to go visit all the meetings. I'm going to decide which one's going to be my home group. And I decided, I chose the 11:30 meeting, which was a meeting I had always avoided because it was called the Clean Air Group. They didn't smoke in that meeting, and I smoked. But that was the meeting that I needed to go to, and I knew it. And I was talking, I think, Mike earlier. Mike's been to that meeting. And it's a great meeting. So I went to that meeting, and I stood up, and I also, for some reason, I didn't want to tell anybody that I'd been sober before. I didn't want to say, because I was a little annoyed by people that would say, stay away from me, I know how AA works, I've been here before, you know. I wanted to be brand new. I wanted to hear everything anew. And we're in the meeting, and I stood up in the meeting, and I know you don't stand up in AA meetings, but I sort of towards the back, I stood up, there's probably 40, 50 people in the room, I said, my name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. I said, we have a problem, I can't stop drinking. And I said, I don't have 30 days to go through a normal socialization process. I said, I really need some friends in here fast. And I said, anybody who will, please come up and say hello to me after the meeting. And I think that was inspired. It's probably the best thing I ever said, because that meeting just adopted me. And they lined up afterwards to meet me. Somebody took me to lunch. And that meeting was also good because it met every single day. So I could go every single day. And they were hugging me, telling me they loved me, and they were all invested. They were all getting invested in me making it, and they wanted me to make it. And I could feel them wanting me to make it. And, you know, when I picked up my 30-day chip, I mean, it almost felt like the people in the room were as excited as I was, if not more. And they just, you know, it was like, that's how this thing works. So, That was very powerful for me, that meeting, and I went to that meeting every single day for 2 to 3 years, I think, and I got very involved up in 8111. I remember, and I was having a spiritual experience. I was having a spiritual experience up there. Nothing else in my life mattered but that meeting at 11:30. The business, I'd stopped caring. Let it go, you know. it doesn't matter. This is what matters. This is the precious thing. Getting sober is the precious thing. And I chose my group well. We had a great, as Mike and I were talking, there was a real cross-section. There was a lot of old sobriety in the room, a lot of people with a lot of time. There was a lot of new people. And I had relationships that were like brothers, that were like sisters. There was a lady, Mary. She was like my grandmother. We would sit out on the porch, and she was like, I call her, human Valium. When I'd sit next to Mary on that swing after a meeting, just something calm came over. And other friends and Back Row Bob, and they've got a little hall of fame now of some of the ones that have died, and a lot of those guys were guys that, you know, helped me so much. And there was Hank would sit there and with his styrofoam cup, and if somebody was hurting, he would write a little message on that styrofoam cup and pass it to them. And it was always just so cool, so cool. So, you know, I did that. I found a sponsor in that meeting. It was a guy I had met the first go-around, and I chose him for my sponsor because I had met him at the lunch meeting, and he seemed more lost and screwed up than I was. He was older than me, and I identified with him because he was kind of a weird dude, and I am too, so I identified with him. And then I get to the... I get to 8111, and there he is, and he's a different guy. He's just a bright beaming like a sunlight, and he's sponsoring people, and he's in the middle of it, and he's organizing the bowling league that we had out of that meeting, and he was in the middle of everything. And I said, wow, something's happened in his life. So I picked him up as a sponsor. And I went to that meeting. I'd think about every night. I'd go to bed and I'd think about the people that meant so much to me in that meeting, because I heard the language of the heart in that meeting, you know, where you're sharing. And I couldn't do a lot of work. I couldn't do my first go round. I vigorously did the steps, and we did the fourth and fifth, and we did all that. And that's good, but I'd had spiritual experience before. And it wasn't radically different from what I'd been through before. I'd been through a whole amends process before I even went to AA. So, and I believe in all that. I think it's spiritually powerful, but I was so sick. I basically, all I could do is go and sit in the meetings. But I heard the language of the heart, you know. I heard these people talking, and I started identifying. I was relating to them. The first time I came into AA, the first time I sobered up, I was looking down on AA a little bit, honestly. I mean, these poor bums. They need this. You know, they really need this. This is not for me. Second time, while I was out drinking, the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous became the smartest, wisest people in the world. Because when I came back, I just looked up. I looked up so much to these people. And again, I'd go to bed at night, and I'd just think about all the different ones. God, I can't wait to see them tomorrow. I wonder what they'll say tomorrow. And just the identifying is so great, and hearing your story and getting relief and getting okay. You know, that's all I wanted. The alcohol made me feel okay. AA was making me feel okay all of a sudden. So I can't say enough about that. I got very involved in 8111 and service work. I remember another, I kind of think maybe God was talking to me, but I was, I've always been a little bit of an entitled type. And I remember being in there, and the coffee pot was a mess. I wanted a cup of coffee, and the coffee pot was a mess. There was no coffee. And I was like, you know, I'll be damned, look at this mess. And, you know, I want a cup of coffee. And the message that came to me was, that's your job. That's your job to do the coffee. So, you know, from then on, I took on that coffee pot. It was my job to clean it up, keep it clean, make sure there was coffee. Just took it on. And what a difference little things like that make. I mean, you know, we learn how to live. We held on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. And I'm still getting so much out of that. I mean, I'm finding old ideas. Boy, it's nice to let some of them go, you know, and to learn new ways. yeah, I got real involved in service work over there, and really enjoyed it. That's been a big deal for me, finding a job in AA. You know, ever since I've been here the last 20, I've always had some job. Right now, I've got the key. I open up our Monday night meeting over at Dunwoody North, and I just have to have something. It's treasure, something. I have to have some kind of connection, something to do the service work. Trying to think what else. It's been a really good deal. I mean, I guess in my first 2 years of sobriety, there were a couple of times, you know, it talks about there will come that time when intellectual argument's not enough, when we'll be challenged, and we need help. And there were a couple of times when I got very frustrated, and I was going to drink. I just decided I wanted to drink. The whole committee, in my head, which they taught me about at that meeting, but the whole committee was pretty much down for drinking. There was one voice on the committee that said, "Well, there's that thing about call your sponsor first." So I called Ken and I said, "Ken, I just can't. I didn't get sober for this." I told him all the things that had happened to me that day, and I said, "I didn't get sober for this. I mean, you know, God hates me. It's clear, and I need a drink." And he said, "You know, he was great. He's kind of codependent, which I needed that. He's not one of those, 'Well, I'll buy it for you.' You know, he's one of those that, 'Oh no, don't drink. I'll get your grand sponsor,' which he did. He got my grand sponsor, and they met me over at this place, and they said, 'Just come and talk to us,' and said, 'Can you just put it off till tomorrow? Look, if you want to drink tomorrow, but just put it off till tomorrow.' And I said, 'Okay, but don't play that AA trick on me, because tomorrow I'm going to drink. I really am.' I mean, I wrote down the date. I said, 'Look, the day will come, and I am going to drink.' But somehow they talked me down, and I think that happened a couple of times, and I haven't needed that since. So a lot to be said for sponsor, and calling your sponsor first. And I've done some sponsoring, and unfortunately, mine tend to call me after they drink. Oh my God, there's not. Yeah, I don't even want to start into that. But much better to reach out before. Trying to think what else. Where are we time wise? We're at. We're pretty good. About 8 minutes. I think I'll do what I like to do a lot of times when I tell my story. We've got about 8 minutes. Would it be okay if we just had a little open discussion? Does anybody want to share out there? And I'll kind of transition into discussion leader, which I also like doing. Is that okay? Can we do that? Just see if anybody wants to share. Maybe I struck a note in somebody out there, and that's what you hope. I mean, it's a language of the heart. That's what happened to me. You just hope you hear your story. You hear a little truth in other. Thanks, everybody. The thing I wanted to close with is, the first gift I got from Alcoholics Anonymous is the gift of sobriety, but the second gift that we talk about with some of my friends is I got the gift of loving meetings, and I think that's a great gift. I mean, that is a powerful thing. I was sharing with Nancy, we love the history, but anyway, thanks a lot. Sorry for going a little late.